Good morning, everybody. Thank you for being a little flexible today, and welcome to the Workforce, Labor, and Economic Development, Finance, and Policy Committee today here March 5th. We have quite a storm outside today, so we are a little fluid today with our agenda. Some members from the public might have noticed we are starting a little bit late today. I want to make sure everybody gets here safe and sound. We do have one member that's on Zoom today joining us. Representative Frazier is on Zoom. I do see a quorum, members. I will look for a motion from Representative Mecklen to pass yesterday's minutes on March 4th. Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I'll move the minutes from Tuesday, March 4th.
Members, any questions on the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Minutes are carried for March 4th. Members, today's agenda has been changed a bit. The first hearing, House File 1355, will be rescheduled for next Tuesday. Due to the weather and the personal impact of this, the families have asked me to move that to next Tuesday, and I approve that. So we'll have House File 1355 rescheduled for Tuesday, March 8th, 9th? Let me get that right. Thank you. I just want to make sure that's
the 11th,
March 11th, next Tuesday. Thank you so much. So with that, members, we're going to move ahead here. Our first, we have one bill on the floor today in the agenda, and we also will have a presentation today with the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board as well. So I want to welcome Representative Robbins to the committee, and House File 23. The chair will move House File 23. To be passed today and to be discussed about and then passed on to the general register. So with that, Representative Robbins, welcome and please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate you hearing the bill. This is an expansion of the Whistleblower Protection Act. And basically what we're doing is adding definitions of waste, fraud, and abuse to the Whistleblower Protection section of statute to ensure that state employees feel they are protected when they come forward with information about where they see in their jobs taxpayer money being wasted, abused, or fraud, maybe credible allegations of fraud occurring. The reason we think it's important to add this to this section of statute is that currently state employees do not feel protected in this category of whistleblowing. And as you'll see, there are already six areas of statute that provide protection of them. And I know some people think that's sufficient to cover waste, fraud, and abuse. But as chair of the fraud committee, I literally can't keep up with the calls and emails I get every week of people wanting to report things. And they are very scared, members. So we want to give them robust protection so that they feel comfortable coming forward, because the people who are in the agencies doing this work and they see problems, they want to clean it up. They want to stop it. They want good government. And yet the fear of our hardworking state employees who want to highlight things that they see as a problem is real. So that's why we're bringing this bill, and I'm happy to stand for questions.
Excuse me. Thank you, Representative Robbins. Are there any testifiers today? I wanted to see if where did they go here? Excuse me. Oh, Mr. Bruce. If Mr. Bruce is here today, there he is. Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Bruce. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Devin Bruce. I'm the Director of Legislative and Political Affairs for the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees, MAPE. We cover about 18,500 state employees across all agencies, board, and commissions. I first want to take the opportunity to thank Representative Robbins for bringing this forward. We've heard a lot of discussions in many different areas regarding fraud, and particularly one that's highlighting the protections and trying to expand employee protections for those who see or experience wrongdoing and want to report it to the authorities or to personnel outside of the OLA. We sincerely appreciate trying to expand that. For House File 23 that does proposed to expand some civil protection to certain employees who are good faith reporting for waste, fraud, and abuse. We have just a couple concerns on the current language that I believe are unintentional. It does expand protections in limited cases defined here, which are outlined of waste, fraud, and abuse, as well as including a qualified recipient of those disclosures to law enforcement officials. However, the current language in this proposal introduces an unnecessary level of complexity for state employees who are already subject to a tiered system of coverage under the Whistleblower Protection Act. Under Subdivision 1, Section 6 of the statute, classified employees in state government are protected from retaliation if the employees, quote, communicate information that the employee in good faith believes to be truthful and accurate and that relates to state services or financing of state services to a legislator, the legislative auditor, or a constitutional officer. This would broadly incorporate all of the concerns and outlines particularly highlighted under the definitions for classified employees. As I've testified before, there is essentially a two-tiered system for coverage of the classification system for state employees. First is the classified service, which has just cause termination rights already. However, under this bill and under the current statute, unclassified employees can be dismissed for no cause. So including broader protections for those unclassified employees who are also reporting fraud would certainly be ideal. The definitions of fraud, waste, and abuse are lifted from, under this bill proposal, are lifted from 127A.21, which creates the OIG office at the Department of MDE. However, what's not carried over here is an important distinction and caveat to those definitions, which exclude certain personnel or other discretionary policy decisions to be covered under those definitions by school districts or similar entities. So for this committee, it's important to refer to 179A.07, Subdivision 1, which outlines inherent managerial policy, which under that definition includes overall budget, utilization of technology, as well as organizational structure. What we would strongly encourage this committee to do is adopt what has been adopted in the Senate companion, which is a simple expansion of Section 6 that I had mentioned previously to cover all public employees, all public employers, and also incorporate the changes that are suggested here to include law enforcement as a qualified recipient of the information. One reminder is that this is not the Whistleblower Protection Act is not a shield, it is a cause of action. And so the more definitions that we have that create unnecessary complexity don't encourage employees to come forward with information. It causes them to feel doubt of whether or not they are covered, and therefore whether or not if they go to court, which is what this does, if they go to court, it is up to the judge to determine whether or not they are covered by fraud, waste, and abuse definitions. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bruce, for your testimony. Is there any other person from the public that would like to testify for or against the bill? Seeing none, I'll close public testimony and take it to member questions. Any members? Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Chair Robbins. So first, I guess, can you talk about the circumstances that are not covered under existing law that your new language would apply to? Because, I mean, clauses 1 through 6 seem quite broad. I can sort of maybe identify a couple situations, but I'm just trying to understand is what you described in your presentation was about feelings of state employees, and I'm wondering is it that you're saying, well, you're not actually expanding the law, but you're just dealing with a concern employees have, or that you're actually saying that there is a change in law, and if so, what are some circumstances that be covered under yours that are not covered under existing law?
Chair Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Pinto. So under sub one, It currently says that the employee in good faith reports a violation, suspected violation, or planned violation of any federal or state law or common law or rule adopted pursuant to law about any, to an employee, I'm sorry, I don't have my cheaters on, adopted pursuant to law to an employer or any government body or law enforcement official. And so some people think that it's broad enough to encompass waste, fraud, and abuse. But in fact, what I hear from agency employees is that that is not sufficient. And similarly, down in sub 6, it says that employee believes to be truthful, accurate, and relates to state services, including the financing of state services. So there is an argument to be made, I would grant you, that that could be inclusive of waste, fraud, and abuse. But because waste, fraud, and abuse is in other sections of statute and not in the whistleblower protection, we feel like it's important to get it in this section. And we also think it's important, currently under 6, they're allowed to give it to a legislator, the OLA, or a constitutional officer, but there is very important concern that we expand that to law enforcement. I have state agency employees who have contacted me who have gone to the FBI and feel like that is outside of what they are protected from doing in the whistleblower statute. So we want to give state employees robust protection so that they feel comfortable flagging things that they find concerning.
Lee Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Robbins, I heard you talk about two different things there that I'm trying to sort through. So, one is I heard you say that, I'm looking at Clause 6, that an employee, that you feel like Clause 6 doesn't encompass waste or abuse. And I'm trying to think about what would be truthful and accurate and relate to state services and yet be a state employee where they're not talking about waste and abuse. Are they talking about waste and abuse that don't relate to state services? In which case, why are we, what is the point? So I'll stop on that. I'll have a separate thing, another thing you talked about. Just to focus on that for a second, I mean, if a state employee is providing truthful and accurate information about state services, I mean, state services, that's, what would be waste and abuse that doesn't relate to state services that we would, sort of, that we should be caring about?
Chair Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Pinto. I understand what you are saying, but I'm telling you from what I hear from state employees, they do not feel comfortable. They are asking for more robust protection. So spelling out in this chapter waste, fraud, and abuse, which are definitions from other chapters, I think is belt and suspenders that gives employees more clear and robust protection. That is what I'm being asked to provide for state employees.
Lee Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to come back to that in a second, what you just said. Just to talk about the second thing for a second, you talked about how Clause 6 doesn't include reports to law enforcement. Clause 1 includes violations of law, rules, et cetera. What is somebody telling law enforcement about that is not a violation of a rule or law? They say, like, hey, I think state funds could be used more effectively. It's not violating the law. I don't want our law enforcement officers tied up with things that are not violations of the law. So what are you thinking of when you talk about somebody making a report to law enforcement that doesn't involve a violation of law or rule?
Waste, Chair fraud, Robbins. And I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, waste, fraud, and abuse. So I understand that they wouldn't necessarily go to law enforcement for waste or maybe abuse, depending on the category, but they definitely want to be able to go to law enforcement when they have credible, substantiated allegations of fraud.
Lee Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, Chair Robbins, but we're again not talking about any violation of the law, though, right? We're talking about fraud that somehow would not violate the law. Because remember, violations of the law are covered under Clause 1. So I just want to make sure we're very clear here. Violation of the law is covered. So you're somehow talking about some kind of, I'm not sure how we'd even call it, fraud that doesn't violate the law, and then we're going to tie up law enforcement with something that doesn't violate the law? I don't understand how that works.
Chair Robbins.
Let me give you an example from the committee last week. Which I'm sure you'll remember, Chair Pinto. So the acting commissioner of DHS came in and said that there is no way for them to act on kickbacks in state law because there's nothing about kickbacks in state law. But she did say the feds can act on that. And so I find it interesting because the DHS already has clear statutory authority to stop payment when there are credible allegations of fraud. But she, on the record, said she was not in a position to do that because kickbacks are in federal statute, not state statute. So clearly there is confusion even at the top of the agencies of whether you can report on kickbacks are fraud. And if that's the view of the top of the agency, that's why I think employees are rightly concerned. So I think providing protection for employees who want to go to law enforcement, and some employees have gone to law enforcement, and they are very concerned about it. So I'm not honestly worried that there's so many people that they're going to go tie up law enforcement's time, or if law enforcement receives a tip that is, they receive tips on lots of things all the time. They're very used to triaging if things that they think don't rise to a credible allegation. So I'm not worried about tying up law enforcement's time. I'm worried about giving employees the protections that will make them feel comfortable to go help us understand what's going on with all these programs and make sure they're running well and not wasting taxpayer money.
Lee Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Robbins, Chair Robbins, I actually understood that discussion a little bit differently than you did on Monday. In fact, my understanding is that actually DHS can and does take action relating to kickbacks. The issue is simply there's not a specific state-level crime regarding kickbacks. Kickbacks can be charged under state law. It's just a more challenging, cumbersome thing to do, which is why they're proposing to create a new state law to do that. I will note, though, that Clause 1 does, in fact, apply to violations of federal law. So if we have our law enforcement officers busy doing all the things that they do, I'm interacting with them in my outside work, assaults and various things, we don't want to be tying up their time with things that are not actual violations of law or rule, which is already covered under Clause 1. I'll have a couple other things, but I think what I'd like to do, Mr. Chair, if I can, I think a couple other members have points, and then I'll have just a couple other things to close with, if that's okay, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Thank Representative you. Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Robbins, there are several members around this table that are hearing a lot of these concerns in regards to fraud because we sit on the fraud committee with you. And certainly I think each of us have probably heard instances or from whistleblowers specifically. I know you are, key among them that are hearing these concerns. And I just, number one, want to say thank you because you're listening to Minnesota workers, specifically state employees. Sometimes Republicans aren't the ones that get the credit for standing up for state employees. And that's what you're doing right now by ensuring that they have the protections that they need. And you specifically have mentioned in your testimony, and I know it's the case from workers, state employees, that they are seeking these protections. And so I just, number one, want to say thank you for that, because we know that Minnesota has seen record-breaking fraud under Governor Walz. It's probably the largest that we've ever seen in state history. And if we don't put in protections like this bill, the concern that we would have, members, is that there's probably an immense amount of fraud that we haven't yet detected because there are workers who don't feel protected today. That's what this is about. That's what this bill is about. I mean, we have seen over $500 million of fraud. And it's so sad as members of the fraud committee to see the number of state employees that are reaching out and have such great concern. I mean, Minnesota, frankly, needs DOGE to look over all of the waste and fraud in government. And this here, with this bill, Representative Robbins, is doing exactly what we need to close the loopholes that exist in state law. So I don't see anything that stands in the way of what is already in law, and instead just provides additional protections to whistleblowers in Minnesota. So I really appreciate you bringing this bill.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning. Sorry, it took me so long to get here. It took about 45 minutes to get from my house. And I think the fact that many of us are on the Fraud Prevention Committee makes this conversation helpful. One of the things both in that committee and here today that I think is important, and I have a few questions on definitions and sort of getting more concrete. We in the Fraud Prevention Committee have not actually heard any conversation about the problem of fraud. We haven't heard from about the business model of Medicaid provider fraud. We haven't heard about what it actually looks like to make government the mark. What we have heard is from our government agencies. So the waste, fraud, and abuse slogan is a challenge, because there is actually, when we talk about fraud, what we should be talking about is people who are not getting the services that they are legally entitled to. We should be talking about government being a mark of fraud across the economy is a problem, whether it's targeting seniors, whether it's targeting veterans, whether it's targeting government. And so to understand what we should be doing here, and we absolutely should be doing things to protect both those benefits and the public coffers that pay for it, we need to understand the problem of fraud. And it's very easy to say fraud and waste and abuse. It's very easy to talk in abstract. So I'm actually wondering, from this bill, and I know that this is a conversation in the Inspector General's the Office of Inspector General bill that is going through committee too, is can we sort of talk in concretes about under this definition, what specifically is an example of waste that we would be worried about? Because I think to what Representative Pinto has said is, to be able to figure out whether the current law covers it, we actually need to get into concrete specifics about what we're talking about. So can you give an example of waste that you're thinking about being covered that a public employee would report?
Chair Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in this bill, the definition of waste is practices that directly or indirectly result in unnecessary costs to programs of a state agency or political subdivision, such as misusing resources. So I could give a lot of examples. I would point across the street to the $730 million state office building that is currently being built, that I have already been told there are serious cost overruns, delays. It is going to go north of 730. I'd also like to point out, we don't need to go down this rabbit hole, but Southwest Light Rail, people have been pointing out cost overruns. There were two OLA reports. Members, we have lots of examples of waste. So happy to continue that conversation.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Robbins. Part of what that's part of what concerns me is waste is not, and as we're seeing at the federal level, we pass the laws. The executive has to faithfully execute. Whether or not you think the state office building of the Southwest Light Rail was a good idea as a public employee, it is your job to execute it. Now, if we're worried about construction overlays, if we're worried about that, one, we're talking about something different than government decisions. We're talking about the decisions of private providers, in this case, construction companies, developers. And I agree. Like, I think we need to make sure that when we are spending government money, one, we are contracting with companies, with providers that are actually doing the services and that are providing the things that we have decided. The idea that waste would be a disagreement with a policy decision that the legislature makes, to me, is a problem. It's a separation of powers problem. But I'm wondering, in that case, how, even in those cases, how that would, an example of abuse? And how would that differ? We have two definitions. We hear again waste, fraud, and abuse. I know what fraud is. I was a public defender. It has a criminal context. It has a civil context, but it's pretty clear. But the waste and abuse piece seem to overlap. But I'm wondering if you can think of, or if you can give me an example of what abuse is that is not waste, and why we need both of these definitions.
Chair Robbins.
Thank you. Just to remind members, the definition of abuse in the bill is that it may directly or indirectly result in unnecessary costs to programs of a state agency or political subdivision. Abuse may involve paying for items or services where there is no legal entitlement to that payment. And I have had people contact me on, unfortunately, several occasions where people are signed up for services that there's concern that they are not eligible for. And I think we saw that writ large with some of the COVID money that the state put out where, you know, we're still struggling to get Medicaid eligibility right. We struggled through unemployment eligibility. So any of those instances where they are not legally entitled to a payment, so a lot of that is what is going to rise to the definition of abuse in this statute. And there are multiple examples where people are receiving services that maybe they are not entitled to. The PCA program is another example. There are so many wonderful PCAs in the state, and God bless them for their hard work. But there's a lot of concern about what is going on with abuse of the PCA program.
Follow up, Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, okay, so in that context, I don't think I heard you say the difference between waste and abuse. I'm wondering, and given how broad these definitions are, and I know you're pulling them from a different part of statute, but also trying to figure out why we need them here, or again, I think that how they contrast with fraud makes sense to me. When I hear, you know, what I hear from state employees, and I don't hear specific. So when we talk about PCA, I think that we should talk about PCA. I think we should talk about Medicaid provider fraud. Again, in that context, usually what we're talking about is a business model, right? If we're talking about the news, is a business model that is created, and the agencies are the mark. And so the question is, what are we trying to do? What are we asking public employees to do? And so I guess I'm just struggling with, under your bill, can you run me through an example, given the what you just described, of from what a piece, what somebody would identify and then report under this bill that they couldn't do if we don't add these definitions and the additional language?
Chair Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Greenman. So there are people who think the current law is sufficient, but these definitions of waste, fraud, and abuse are from other sections of statute, so we're trying to align the whistleblower statute with other definitions of waste, fraud, and abuse in other sections of statute and give employees comfort. Some of the examples I cited are from people who see these things going on, and under current law, they can go to a legislator or a constitutional officer or the OLA. But when they come to me as a legislator, and this is a whole different topic, they can tell me general things, but I cannot receive protected data under Chapter 13. So when people bring me actual, like, data about levels of fraud, I have to decline and say, I cannot receive anything protected under Chapter 13, so please go tell the OLA or please go tell the FBI. And that is something else I think we need to deal with, if not in the scope of this bill. But so there are people who feel that the sort of general report on things that's in the current statute is not sufficient when they are identifying specifically waste, fraud, and abuse. And that is why, to provide strength and comfort to them and legal definitions in the whistleblower statute, we want to have this language. And I've had conversations with Chair Pinto, with Devin. I get that this language, maybe the definition of abuse and waste are very close. When I first read this bill, I was like, wow, huh, those definitions are kind of very similar. So I take your point, Representative Greenman, but my advice from the nonpartisan support who helped us is that we want to keep statute aligned. So we were taking the statute language drafted, I believe, last year for the Department of Education, OIG, and bringing it into the statute. If we want to realign the broader definitions of waste, fraud, and abuse across statute, I'm happy to work on that. But for the short term, having statute aligned and giving workers protection is the goal of this bill. And Chair Pinto and I have talked even last night, and we are going to continue to work on language that we both feel serves the need of the public to bring forward concerns. And so I'm open to continuing those conversations. I'm also open to the conversation about adding unclassified to the list. I think that's a good suggestion, and I've talked to Devin about that. So I'm not saying, like, this is the end-all and be-all, but I do have concerns about not doing anything, because the current statute has not felt like sufficient protection to people. To your point that we haven't dealt with some of this in the fraud committee, the reason is people are afraid to come forward. People are afraid to come and give public testimony. That is why we're doing high-level overviews with agencies, because the people who would like to bring more specificity to the conversation are not comfortable doing that in a public forum. I have a very high-level guest who knows a lot about the business model of fraud, who declined to testify publicly, and, you know, I will be meeting with that individual privately. So this is not a made-up issue. This is a real issue, and I feel like, yes, maybe we need to work on some additional strength to the definitions, but we need to make sure the whistleblower protection section of statute actually addresses waste, fraud, and abuse. Thank you.
Any final follow-up, Representative Greenman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize. We're having two conversations, but we've been having this. We don't hear these bills in the committee, and I really appreciate the your focus on adding protections, adding, because I agree with you, like, and I think we should have the Medicaid fraud control unit at the Attorney General's office. I think oftentimes, I mean, we have this with worker protections too. We oftentimes have a hard time having folks come in. It's an intimidating space, and share their stories. So I appreciate that. I think there's lots of ways we can get at it. But I agree with you that when we talk about fraud, and part of my, and I'd love to work with you on definitions, is I think that the issue of fraud, and when we say waste, fraud, and abuse, because Representative Schultz brought up what's happening at the federal level, but at the same time, we waste, fraud, and abuse is using for this DOGE thing. There are workers who are being fired without protections. There are, at the same time, the inspectors, 17 inspectors general have been fired. The head of the Department of the Office of Ethics have been fired. They've are not enforcing the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. And so my concern is, here in Minnesota, we should actually be looking at the problem we're trying to solve, because I agree with you, we should not do nothing. We need to protect the people who want to get who need the autism services, who need the child care, who need the health care. Like, that's our job, and we should protect that. We need to protect the resources that are available to provide those services so that folks can live the happy and thriving lives that we all want them to. And that's not what's happening at the federal government right now. The federal government is talking about cutting those services, and 14 members have written a letter. 14 of your colleagues have written a letter. So to me, we should not confuse those conversations, because waste, fraud, and abuse right now is being used as a political boogeyman at the federal level in order to go after folks' political rivals, in order to fire public workers, not to protect them. And so I appreciate the spirit of this bill and what you're talking about, which is protecting workers, protecting the public coffers, and getting at this problem here in Minnesota, but trying to confuse it with what's happening at the federal level, which is a full-scale violation of the separation of powers, and also hurting federal workers, 18,000 of whom live in Minnesota. It's just, it is bad and probably illegal policy, and we're not doing that here. I'm not confusing that with here, but I don't want to start. So with that, Mr. Chair, I will yield.
Representative Frazier.
Mr. Chair, may I respond?
Oh, I'm sorry, yes. I didn't hear a question, but go ahead.
Oh,
Chair Robinson.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Greenman. I appreciate your acknowledgement that this bill is completely separate from anything going on elsewhere in the country, and that we have a real fraud problem here in Minnesota. And that is the focus of this bill. I want to protect workers here. I don't think bringing in the other conversation is helpful to the work we need to do here in the state. And so there is a real issue here. We need to protect our workers. We need to expand their ability to report to law enforcement. And that is our job as legislators. So I just want to reiterate that. I think there are efforts that were just said that we're trying to confuse and conflate those issues. And that is not what this bill does.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Robbins, for bringing the bill. And I agree with my colleague, Representative Greenman, that it is important for us to protect our workers. And I'll have something to say about that a little bit, because I do think what's happening at the federal level is informative of what we're doing because of the harm that's being done there and workers losing their job. But I think that's possibly where we could be headed with the narrative that is happening right now with this narrative of waste, fraud, and abuse. But a couple of questions right off the top would be, one, is this bill going to the fraud committee that you chair?
Chair Robbins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Frazier, no, it is not.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Robbins, I don't understand this. This is specifically related to fraud. Why would it not go to a committee that is related to fraud?
Chair Robbins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Frazier. Well, because I'm the chair of the Fraud Committee. I'm carrying the bill. It's already been, this is its second committee stop. Members of the Fraud Committee serve on this committee. It would just be redundant, and we want to get it moving.
Representative Frazier.
So from my understanding, you're the chair of the Fraud Committee. You have a bill that is directly related to fraud, but you didn't want the bill to start in your Fraud Committee.
Chair Robbins. Not sure I heard a question.
Yes, Chair Baker, Representative Frazier. I didn't direct the path of the bill. It was sent first to the other committee, then it was sent to Workforce, and I'm very comfortable with that path. I'm the bill author. I could have reached out to myself for a hearing, I guess, but I didn't need it. So I'm very comfortable with the path the bill is on. It has been vetted twice here in the House in committee. It has been moved through the Senate. This bill has, interestingly, it had complete bipartisan support in the Senate and has not yet had that in the House, which I find interesting. But I'm hoping that we will get this across the finish line, and I'm very committed to that work.
And I think to that, Chair Robbins, I think it went through State Gov Finance before it became to this.
That is correct.
This committee here as well. Any follow-up, Representative Frazier?
Yes, Mr. Chair, please.
Go ahead.
Yeah, to Representative Robbins, I understand your comments around that it's bipartisan, maybe have bipartisan support in the Senate, but I think you are absolutely explicitly hearing the concerns that are being raised here by some of my colleagues, which is why you may not have had bipartisan support in the House yet. Doesn't mean you will not, but you are absolutely hearing concerns, which is why this committee process is important. And I may have a disagreement with you on why it did not go through your fraud committee. If I was a chair of fraud committee, I probably would want a bill directed to fraud to come through my committee, but that's your choice. The other question I have is, how about the Judiciary Committee? Will this bill go to the Judiciary Committee?
Chair Robbins.
Chair Baker, Representative Cedric Frazier. I'm sorry, Representative Frazier. No, it has not been referred to Judiciary, and Representative Scott has not requested it.
And after this stop, Representative Frazier, it's on its way to the General Register. Representative Frazier?
My concern is that this bill will go to the Judiciary Committee in the Senate. Why is it not following a similar path here in the House?
Representative Frazier, it's on its way to General Register. That was after consulting with the other chairs, that's the direction of this bill. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Chair Baker. I would like a motion to send this bill to Judiciary. We are expanding protections, and whenever we expand protections, and particularly where there's an opportunity for litigation, I think that discussion should be had in the Judiciary Committee.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. There's a motion to move this to the Judicial Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye. What? Excuse me? A roll call has been requested. There will be a roll call. Chair votes no.
Meckland?
No.
Bakeberg?
No.
Berg?
Yes.
Frazier?
Yes.
Greenman?
Yes.
Pete Johnson?
Yes.
Wayne Johnson?
No.
Koslowski?
Yes.
Mueller?
Mueller votes no.
Schultz?
Schultz, no.
Zalesnikar?
Zalesnikar, no.
Seeing five ayes and six noes, the motion is...
Seven
noes, the motion is not adopted. Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate you bringing this bill forward on this committee. We are here to protect workers, and so whenever I hear that there is an effort to do that, I appreciate it. I appreciate that you are considering taking the language to further protect unclassified workers. I think that's a great move. I mean, by and large, what I'm hearing is you can barely keep up with the complaints that all of these employees are sending you. Saying that over and over again doesn't make it true. And I think the fact that that Representative Cleavehorn in the State Gov Committee said this bill wasn't ready, not sending it to Judiciary, not sending it to your own committee, which is the definition of this bill, makes this largely a political move. And tying all of this into the national narrative of waste, fraud, and abuse and what DOGE is doing, which has an unelected, unchecked billionaire accessing all of our personal data. Tying all of this to that should be concerning. And we already have laws in place. There are ethic laws that protect workers. The OLA has the authority to review anonymous complaints and the ability to protect workers when they do come forward with complaints. So why are you actually trying to duplicate what we already have in law? And saying that we want to protect workers isn't good enough when your side of the aisle constantly votes against every worker protection bill we bring forward. So why the duplicity in what we already have in law?
Chair Robbins.
Mr. Chair and Representative Berg, I'm disappointed that you're doubting my integrity by saying I cannot keep up with the number of whistleblowers. Literally, I'm trying to just create a spreadsheet, and I don't get back to people, and people are frustrated because I do not have time to get back to everyone who has reached out to me. So I'm very disappointed in that. I'm also disappointed that the members on your side are the ones who are complaining about conflating with this with federal issues. I've never said that. I am not making that case. You guys are the ones who keep conflating this with what's going on in Washington. Members, we are trying to protect workers. We are trying to give them security to come forward and deal with the real problem of fraud we have in Minnesota. And this bill, I'm happy to work on the language about adding unclassified. I'm happy to even work on expanding or clarifying some of the definitions of waste, fraud, and abuse, but I want to do it in a way that is respectful of the scope of statute so that we're not creating more inconsistencies. But there is a real problem, and the fact that it's not being acknowledged is honestly shocking. And I will keep doing this work, and I hope that we get your support. My intention is to have it be bipartisan like it is in the Senate. I've had great conversations with members on your side who care about this issue. So I'm hoping, members, that this will be a strong bipartisan signal to state employees that we appreciate their hard work and that we want them to come forward when they feel there is a concerning issue going on. That's the point of this bill. That's my intention, and I will continue to push forward with that.
Thank you, Chair Robbins. Final question, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first off, I'd just like to request a roll call on this bill as we move it forward, because this is right in Chapter 181, fully within the jurisdiction of this committee, which is why it's before us. Representative Robbins, you've done a great job, and I just want to continue to encourage you to work closely with all the legislators. And the fact of the matter is, this morning, you're bringing forward a bill that supports and protects workers, and at the same time, the members of this committee had the opportunity ahead of this meeting to bring any amendments to make this bill better. And I know that you're committed to doing that throughout this process, but it's important that we see this bill through. So I encourage support.
Mr. Chair, could I respond?
Sure. Chair Robbins.
I just want the record to note that Representative Pinto was working on an amendment with me, and just because our schedules were both incredibly locked up yesterday, we didn't get to it, but we are continuing to have those conversations. So I just want to acknowledge that he was working on bringing an amendment today, and it didn't happen.
All right. Thank you for that. I don't see any more. One final, real quick, because we got to save time for the next presentation. So final comment, Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Chair Baker. And as you can tell, I think we've been waiting to hear these bills in the Fraud Committee, Prevention Committee. That's part of why this has been such a robust discussion. I do just want to, and I feel like there's some accusations that we're getting from the other side of the aisle that, one, we're not interested in working on this. We're not interested in working on this with you. What I will say is that, again, I think that both if you look at the legislation that's going through, if you look at the governor's package, if you look at the things that have been happening in the last couple of years, including, I mean, our first two presentations, we heard about all of the changes that have happened. It is clear that the idea that we want to protect both the services that people deserve and the government resources that are paid for that, I think is a bipartisan issue. What I will say is that it is hard to not see it as a political project when on the before we even met, you signed a letter along with the leadership in the House, the Republican leadership in the House, to ask the Attorney General to investigate the Walz administration for a number, $610 million. We still haven't sort of in committee heard that detailed. But again, you can't accuse us of making this a federal or tying it to the federal issue. This happened before, I think, our first fraud hearing, a fraud committee hearing. And what it says to me is that this asking the Attorney General, who was appointed by a president, who not only fired 17 inspectors general, the head of the Department of Ethics, gutted the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, but also is famously and now showing retributive against his political opponents, of which Governor Walz is a political opponent who ran against him. To me, this makes it hard to be in the project together, because what this feels like is it's a political project. That's what this letter asking to investigate the Walz administration, asking President Trump and Pam, Attorney General Bondi to do it. So I really hope, and I think in the committee, we have shown that we're interested in, I know that Chair, that Lead Pinto has been working on this language. I know other folks have. I know it's happening in the Senate. But it's hard not to bring in the federal issues that are happening, the corruption, the chaos, the cruelty, without actually looking at the that was brought in before our first hearing. So with that, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, if I'm...
Chair Robbins, final comments before we pass it off.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Greenman. I want to highlight that there has been documented $610 million of abuse and waste and fraud here in the state, and we will dive into that more in the committee. But my main point in signing that letter to Attorney General Pam Bondi is to request that they appoint a U.S. attorney here in Minnesota, which you did not cite, which is part of that letter, because the Democrat-appointed U.S. attorney, Andy Lugar, did phenomenal work here in the state uncovering and prosecuting the Feeding Our Future case and other instances of fraud. And without an attorney general here appointed in Minnesota, we are lacking that vital resource. A lot of this money is passed through. It's federal money, and it gets needs to be prosecuted by the federal U.S. attorney here. And so I really wanted to have my stake in the ground asking the federal government to get a new U.S. attorney appointed here in Minnesota as soon as possible.
To that,
I want to get that on the record.
Thank
I
you,
hope
Chair.
You will support this
Hang
bill.
Hang on, Let's Chair support. Robbins. I am going to go to Lead Pinto for one short thing.
Well, just and Chair, because I said to come back, I'm going to have a quick motion and then a statement. And the motion relates to the fraud committee that Chair Robbins is the chair, and I'm the lead. And Chair Robbins, I was struck when you first started, you talked about state employees not feeling protected and that being the goal. And you, right from the very start, all this has all been about your role as chair of the fraud committee. I have not heard any reason that this bill wouldn't go to that committee other than the chair simply not wanting to hear it. And we have to, in our body, and you and I had a private conversation about this, and I'm going to continue to bring this up. We have to have sort of rules and guidance that we all understand. And the whim of the chair can't be the entire reason. I mean, our committee hears bills relating to workforce, labor, and economic development. And like there's sort of an understanding. And everything about this conversation has been all related to preventing fraud and overseeing agencies. That's the entire point. And literally the name of the committee is Fraud Prevention Agency Oversight. So, Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask Representative Greenman to move, since I can't, to re-refer the bill to the Fraud Prevention Agency Oversight Committee and request a roll call. I'm going to have a quick statement after that before we close.
Thank you. Quick, Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd ask that we refer the bill to the Fraud Prevention and Government Oversight Committee.
Is that a roll call vote?
And I request a roll
call. And a roll call vote. Okay. Members, roll call has been ordered and asked for. Ann, please go ahead. Chair votes no.
Meckland?
No.
Akeberg?
No.
Berg?
Yes.
Frazier?
Yes.
Greenman?
Yes.
Pete Johnson?
Yes.
Ian Johnson?
No.
Kozlowski?
Yes.
Mueller?
Mueller votes no.
Schultz?
No.
Zalesnikar?
Zalesnikar, no.
Seeing five ayes and seven noes, the motion is not adopted. Final comments, Lead Pinto.
Thank you, Chair. So just I'll say I do think there is a problem to be solved here. This is why Chair Robbins and I have been talking about language. But as this is written, this would pull in all sorts of situations that are not actually solving the problem. And in particular, most of the things that were identified are situations that are already covered under existing law. So it's a narrow set of circumstances that need to be expanded consistent with Mr. Bruce's testimony. So I would urge, I'm disappointed that we couldn't have the conversation in the other committee. That's where we should have continued to do that. So I would urge members at this time to vote no to not move the bill forward. But then assuming that it does, then I certainly hope that we can make the changes to actually make this bill work. Thank you, Chair, both chairs.
Chair Robbins, final thoughts on House File 23. Thank you for bringing it to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for a very robust discussion. I hope you will support this effort to protect workers. The reason that we need this is the same reason the Democrats put these same definitions of fraud, waste, and abuse in the Department of Education's Office of Inspector General language last session. The language was good enough last session for the Democrats, and it should be good enough this session when we are trying to extend those same categories of protection for state employees who want to report on waste, fraud, and abuse in the agencies. I appreciate the conversation. I look forward to continuing the work, and I hope we can get this past this session. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Robbins. I appreciate it. And again, with those closing comments, the chair will renew my motion to move House File 23 under the general register. Having a roll call being called, roll call will be made. Chair votes aye.
Meckland?
Aye.
Akeberg?
Yes.
Berg?
No.
Frazier?
No.
Pete Johnson?
Nope.
Wayne Johnson?
Yes.
Kozlowski?
No.
Mueller?
Mueller votes yes.
Greenman, sorry.
No.
Schultz?
Aye.
Zalesnikar?
Zalesnikar, yes.
Thank you, members. Seeing a roll call of seven ayes and five noes, the House File 23 is on its way to General Register. Thank you so much, Representative. Members, that brings us up to our final presentation today. I'd like to welcome Leah Solo to the testifying table. We'll be hearing about the Nursing Home Standards Board today. So welcome to the committee, Director. And when you're ready, please proceed. Go ahead and get set up. There you go. All right, there you go. Ms. Solo, please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Baker. Thank you, committee, for having me here today. Happy to be sharing a little bit of information about the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board and our work so far over the last 18 months. For the record, my name is Leah Solo, and I'm the Executive Director for the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board. I've been serving in this role since the board got appointed back in August of 2023. So what is the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board? We were created in law in 2023 during the legislative session. Our purpose is to conduct investigations into working conditions in the nursing home industry and adopt rules establishing minimum employment standards reasonably necessary and appropriate to protect the health and welfare of nursing home workers. And I'll go into a little bit more about what exactly that means. The board itself is made up of 9 members. We have 3 commissioners or commissioner designees. Those are from the Department of Labor and Industry, the Department of Human Services, and the Minnesota Department of Health. There are also 6 members that are appointed by the governor, 3 representing employers and 3 representing workers. These were all appointed in August and September of 2023. All right. And the board got straight to work in 2023. We set up a basic structure, including bylaws, and then we employed a kind of work group structure. So we started with 3 work groups. We're now up to 6 because a number of issues have come up that that we've needed to address in that structure. The work groups include 1 commissioner or commissioner designee, 1 from the employers, and 1 from the workers. That's the least that we have so that all voices are heard. Additionally, we invite advocates to be at the table so that we can have open conversation, and those advocates are invited by board members to sit at the table and be part of that conversation in a non-voting way. Those work groups have been busy. In those first 14 months, we had 48 work group meetings, so there was a lot of conversation that was had. We also had 25 full board meetings. So, again, a lot of issues that we've discussed and talked through together. So a little bit more, you heard that word investigation in our purpose. I will say I try to use the words research, research through data and public engagement. I find that that the word investigation has all sorts of negative connotations. So we talk a lot about the research that we've done. And I'll draw your attention to that phrase that I have bolded there, adopt minimum nursing home employment standards that meet or exceed existing industry conditions for a majority of nursing home workers. I call that the majority benchmark. That's in statute. And it really directed the board to make sure that whatever standards we were going to put into rules were raising up at least 50% of workers. So how we went about doing that research. First of all, there's our public engagement. So in statute, it asks us to take testimony from workers and employers. So we took that very seriously. We did 5 public forums in February and early March of 2024. 3 of those were in person, 1 in Brooklyn Park, 1 in Duluth, and 1 in Redwood Falls, and 2 were virtual. We had 224 folks that participated in those forums. And oddly, they ended up splitting evenly between workers and employers as far as speakers. I felt like that was a good indication that we were creating forums that were welcoming to both employers and workers to come and give their opinions to the board. We also had 3 questionnaires. We know not everyone has time to come to a forum, so we wanted an online way for folks to engage with the board, and about 200 people participated in those as well. So a second part of our work researching was through data. We looked at several data sets, one from the from DEED, one from or some from the Department of Labor and Industry, and then some from Department of Human Services. So for instance, we looked at the cost of living data that DEED tracks. And then we landed on a really important data set from Human Services that allowed us to actually look at data and see what a minimum wage, any minimum wage that we would put what that would do for workers. So the percentage of workers that would be affected by raising the floor. So that was a very important set of data that we looked at. We also had advocates representing the employers that also brought their data. We talked a lot about that in our data work group. And as a full board, that was data that came from surveys. And I think it was an important perspective for us to examine as a board. So that work was all done in the winter of 2023-24 and into the early spring. That led us to 8 full board meetings that we dedicated to discussing the data and heard different options of how we could set these standards. And so obviously with 8 full board meetings, there was a lot of robust discussion about how we could structure things. So then going on to what we landed on for the minimum wage standards. And I'll just, put in context, we had a deadline of November 1st, 2024 to, complete our first set of rulemaking. So we really wanted to make sure that we were, moving things along to meet that deadline. As you all know, even with expedited rulemaking, things still take from 4 to 6 months to get through the process. So we landed on 2 sets of rules. They were both passed on May 9th, 2024, and then went into the process of rulemaking. This first set of standards that I'll talk about, the earliest that those can go into effect is January 1st, 2026, because it was determined that those needed an appropriation from the legislature. So those are on hold until that appropriation is obtained and federal approval is obtained as well. So what is in those initial minimum wages? What's up on the board right now? I'll say a couple things about these. So first, there is a general minimum wage. This would apply to folks like folks that work in dietary, laundry, housekeeping, activity aides, those kinds of folks. So folks that really do a lot of really important work in the nursing homes. We have one minimum wage for January 1st, 2026 and one for 2027. I think we've seen this in a lot of minimum wages as they go into effect kind of with a 1-2 step. So that is how we structured that. There's then a specific minimum wage for certified nursing assistants, one for trained medical assistants, and one for licensed practical nurses or LPNs. The important thing to point out about these is that they meet the majority benchmark. So I have a 14-page memo that lays out how those final proposals that we had did or did not meet the majority benchmark, and these did. So that was important for the board to understand. The second set of rules was a set that went into effect January 1st, 2025. So these are in effect right now. These were also passed May 9th of 2024 and then went into rulemaking. The rulemaking, of course, included mailings out to interested parties, including, for instance, all nursing home administrators. So they all received notice that this was a rule that we were intending to adopt. What is included in these rules? So first of all, there's holiday pay of time and a half for workers on 11 state holidays. This was a something that rose to kind of the top of our questionnaires. So the questionnaire, the top three were of things that folks wanted to see was one, a raise in pay. 100% of people answered that they would like to see a raise in pay. Second was health insurance. And then tied for third was holiday pay and pensions. So I think the board thought that this was a good start based on that feedback that we got from workers. The second set of things in this set of rules was a certified worker organization process. So statute directs the board to set up a process to certify worker organizations to do trainings with workers to ensure that they're aware of their rights under our statutes. And then finally, there were requirements for nursing homes to notify workers of their rights. These are called posting requirements. That's when you see, you know, the poster on the bulletin board saying, you know, what your rights are. So the final thing that I just wanted to share with the committee is about our waiver and variance process. Statute also directs the board to develop a process for temporary waivers and variances if a nursing home feels that they are at risk of closure or receivership due to our statutes. The board had a unanimous agreement on this process and thought it was very important that we have an ability to give a waiver or variance from our rules. We launched that on December 1st, 2024, and we had several options for nursing homes to let us know that they were that they might be at risk of closure or receivership due to our standards, and we would be able to give them a response before the holiday pay rules went into effect. So we were ready to do that. As of yesterday, when I last checked, we haven't received any applications for a waiver or variance. So with that, thank you so much for having me, and I'm happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Director Solo. I have one question quickly, and then I think we've got a couple of folks on the list here. Page 10, you're talking about the minimum wages, and at the bottom it says standards met majority benchmark. What does majority benchmark mean in this setting?
Yes. So that is a reference back to that place in statute that says that the board needed to adopt minimum nursing home employment standards that meet or exceed existing industry conditions for a majority of nursing home workers. So we had to look to see if those minimum wages would raise up or meet the current conditions for a majority of workers.
Thank you. I just want to get that clarified. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do recognize that, you know, of the nine-member board, certainly there was conversation when this legislation was originally passed 2 years ago with concern around exactly the balance for the board. And I just wanted to ask, you know, with the report in particular, is this something that there was wholesale agreement on from members of the board?
Great.
Director Solo.
Chair, representative. So there were several things that there was unanimous agreement on. For instance, our process for certified worker organizations and our posting requirements, there was agreement on. For the holiday pay and for the minimum standards, we had 6 votes in favor and 3 abstentions.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with regard to the folks who weren't in agreement on this, was there a minority report provided? And is that included in your report?
Director Solo.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there was a minority report submitted to the board and given to me. There is nothing in statute directing the executive director to submit a minority report to the legislature. And the statute around the annual report that I'm supposed to submit makes it very clear that it is supposed to be about our progress on rulemaking. So that minority report was not submitted.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, especially given the vast concerns that we had when this was originally passed, that, you know, I believe that every voice deserves to be heard. And so I'm very concerned that it appears as though some are left without a voice in the minority report, especially if, and it sounds like they did, submit something to you. So I think especially for the legislature's purposes, that should be considered. I do have an additional question for you. You know, when we talk about the wages, when we talk about holiday pay, when we talk about a whole host of the decisions that were made here, I just want to ask you, in light of the fact that families across this state are dealing with immense challenges related to affordability, what did the board do to consider the cost of each of these new mandates on employers that ultimately get passed on to consumers?
Director Solo.
Chair, Representative, so there is a section of the statute that directs the way that we are supposed to cost out any standards. So we worked with the Department of Human Services to work through their process of how anything would be costed, and we followed those rules.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's just worth noting that is, each of these instances are likely to raise the cost of nursing home care, long-term care. And, you know, frankly, I have not spoken with a Minnesotan in the last 5 years who has told me that long-term care is affordable. And so, especially considering that this is made up of a board where, you know, there's no one who's elected to it, that's concerning for us in the legislature as it relates to how this is going. Mr. Chair, I know there's other questions. I do have more, but I will return to you.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. Director Solo, I didn't realize there was a minority report. Is that something that is available upon request?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, thank you so much. I will request that to be sent to my committee administrator.
Absolutely.
We'll send that out. Thank you so much. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your presentation. So along with some of the questions that Representative Schultz brought up, I was looking at your presentation and noticing that on slide 11 and slide 12, you talked about how the adoption of the rules for holiday pay and all these others, the draft was posted May 9th, the notice of intent to adopt August 26th, approved October 31st. The notice of adoption was published December 9th. Standard becomes effective January 1st. And then on the next page, you said the waiver and variance process for those who are at risk of being closed was launched December 11th, 2 days after notice of adoption. How were the nursing homes and other long-term care facilities informed about this waiver process? Because frankly, my husband works at a nursing home and long-term care facility as a chaplain. He sees the revolving door of workers and understands how difficult it is to find workers. He understands how difficult it is for families to afford what is happening. He's pretty involved in this process, and this is the first I've ever heard of a waiver that our nursing homes who are at risk of closure or receivership have been able to apply to. You say there's been no application since March 4th, as of March 4th. Is it possible they just have no idea this is even a possibility? Thank you, Chair.
Director Solo.
Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. We included this in, we sent out several emails to folks, so anyone who has signed up in our for notice of our activities. And I think we've, you know, there was a lot of discussion with advocates. So so we used the tools that we had to let folks know.
Any follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sent emails. I don't know about anyone else, but I get about 27 emails in like an hour, unfortunately. And I know, I'm sure there's lots of nursing home administrators that are just the same. You talked about the outreaches that you did. Was this mentioned at all? I mean, I noticed in the outreach meetings, there wasn't any in my area. I know there was virtual ones, and that's great because that allows a lot of people to be on there, and so that's fantastic. Was that ever mentioned, or was that not something that was that was planned ahead of time? Maybe just, oh, whoops, we need to be able to do this now? I mean, we get lots of emails. It's very easy to be like, oh, my gosh, here's another one. Okay, let me try to read and sift through the information. Is there anything specific, like bold letters, neon something, hey, we know this is going to be hard. Here's a way for you to do it. You talk about how we use the tools that we had, and we've talked through application. Does that mean some people tried to apply, but then they were talked out of it? I don't understand your answer. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Director Solo.
Chair, Representative. Let's see, there were a couple of questions.
Yeah, I apologize.
No, that's okay. Sorry.
Did you mention any of them in your meetings that you did when you did some outreach first?
Director Solo.
Mr. Chair.
Representative. The forums that we did in the spring of 2024 were very focused on the standards that we were creating. We did, our open meeting law applies to our board, so we had at least four, maybe more, open meetings during that discussed our process and developing our process for waivers and variances. So we definitely discussed that open to the public. As far as in those forums, we did not discuss a waiver and variance process, but it was developed over several months in the fall of 2024.
Any follow-up, or I'll move on?
I think I'm good, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Zeleznikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for your presentation on this nursing home standard. I'd like to ask a couple questions. And the first one is working conditions is one of the focuses of the group, which I love. I've been working on that in my career as a nursing home administrator. So my questions are on the piece of the holidays. The 11 holidays on page, I don't even know what page it is, but it lists out there the 11 holidays. I'm curious as to how you selected the 11 holidays, because the federal holidays are different than the state list. And from my experience working for 30 years as a nursing home administrator, the employee engagement is what drove the holidays. So we had holidays. And we always had time and half pay for holidays. But the issue that I see in here, and I wonder your perspective, I'd like to know how you got to these holidays. For example, federal holiday has Christmas Day. That's not on the list here. Christmas Day is not one of the 11 holidays that this group came up with. I've never not had a Christmas Day in a contract that employees wanted in 30 years of being a nursing home administrator. So there are some important pieces that were part of employee engagement on how they selected that. And I'm interested in your thoughts on that, because the holidays that if a facility had 7 or 8 holidays, and now they have to add to get to the 11, the issue isn't having holidays and adding more. The issue is that this board allowed for the holidays to go through at time and a half without funding. And the funding comes from this chamber in the House of Representatives. So that is the issue, not the issue of if we expand holidays. I would love some clarification on how you came up with the 11, but the reality is that ultimately, has the board considered the impact? The governor's budget has a 2% cap for nursing homes, which means that the theory that the nursing homes will recapture this money after they do their financial audit and they give it, they submit them, because nursing homes have to submit an audit. Every single thing's line item audited. And then in 18 months, they get their rates sent back to the nursing homes, 300 of them in the state of Minnesota, based on their costs. That establishes the rates. So they carry these expenses for 18 months. The costs could come up where the rate should go up more than 2%. The governor's budget says it will be capped at 2%. That means all these costs and the premise that they will eventually get paid is not accurate, because that mechanism has been removed for that. And that is the issue for the nursing homes across the state, is one, carrying the costs up front, because in the other section of this rule, it talks about creating the wages, which I understand we've been fighting for these type of wages historically. So I don't have a problem with that. I love paying employees the highest amount we can in health care. The issue is that it states there has to be funding. So this came without funding. That is 100% what my question to the board is. What will be the mechanism to fund this with a governor cap at a 2% increase max if the costs are higher than that?
Director Solo.
Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. So first on the 11 state holidays, my apologies, I'm not sure which list you're looking at, but Christmas is definitely on there. So it's the 11 holidays that are in state statute, which are New Year's Day, MLK, President's Day, Memorial Day, in Juneteenth, July 4th, Indigenous Peoples Day, Labor Day, and Thanksgiving, Veterans Day, and Christmas. So those are the 11 state holidays that are in statute and are included in our rules. We do actually have a mechanism in the rules so that if employees and employers come to an agreement, they can swap out up to 4 holidays. So, for instance, one of the things that was often cited was Easter. Folks want time and a half on Easter, so we wanted to make it able for folks to agree on that and have that be the case. Let's see, on the funding for specifically for holidays, as I mentioned, there is part of our statute that dictates how we are supposed to cost things out. And as you know, values-based reimbursement is tied to the forecast. And so it was determined that holiday pay would fall under what it is also already assumed to go up, how the rates are already assumed to go up. And I apologize, I'm here today. I'm not the expert on how things are costed in values-based reimbursement. And I'm certainly happy to get more information on that if the committee needs it. But I know that's the kind of two-sentence answer on why there is not an appropriation needed for holiday pay. It's just how the statute is written. As far as the funding for the minimum wages, those are obviously, as I already said, those do need an appropriation from the legislature, and it is, as statute dictates, it is back here for you all to decide exactly what that looks like.
Is there a quick follow-up, Representative? Because I've got one more member to get to, and we're on top of the hour. So thank you. If we could be brief.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you. Thank you for clarifying Christmas, because it's important to people.
Yeah, absolutely.
The reality is the $10 million question here is this was passed without funding. And so the cost for the nursing homes across the state is $20,000 on a small nursing home. And these value-based reimbursements with the proposed governor budget to cap it, there will not be reimbursement for those costs incurred. So the premise assumes that X happens. And if X happens and there is no funding, which is the proposal, then those are not going to be costs that the nursing homes get their money. 69% of the funding is state funding for Minnesota medical assistance in nursing homes. So this the chamber at the state sets that funding. For the record, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. Final.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate this conversation. I think the cost and the funding for our nursing homes, our nursing home employees, the folks who, the residents, is really on a lot of our minds. I'm wondering. I know that 80% of the coverage is not paid by residents themselves, but by MA medical assistance, which we get from the federal government. I know Chair Baker signed on to a letter concerned about the GOP's budget, which we're all going to have to respond to at the federal level, cutting, making deep cuts to Medicaid or to MA. I'm wondering, as you are thinking about the working conditions and standards, if the board has looked into how this could impact, how those funding cuts could impact that. What I heard Representative Zalesnikar say is that the concern about the ability to be able to pay. I know we've heard in other committees that there's just concern about being able to stay open. But when we think about the working conditions and the role of this committee and the standards, it feels like an 80% cut. It's not going to be paid for by residents. Frankly, it'll be paid for by the families and folks who have to care for those folks and won't have not long-term care at all. So I'm wondering if you're looking into that as a board.
Director Solo.
Chair, Representative, we have not had a full board meeting yet in March, but I have a feeling folks might bring it up.
All right. Thank you very much for your presentation today, Director. I know that we are at end of time. Members, that concludes our work today. I want to remind members that tomorrow we have a very busy day ahead of us, House File 500. We also have some presentations from Summit Academy, the Higher Nonprofit, and also the NDCs. And House File 1469 will be on deck tomorrow, too. So, members, we have concluded our business. We are adjourned.